Welcome, everybody, to another edition of the Inside Indy Sports Podcast. I'm Tyler James, and I'm joined once again by the one and only Eric Hansen. Together, we cover Notre Dame football, recruiting, and more for InsideIndySports.com on the Rivals Network. The Inside Indy Sports Podcast is presented by Dead Soxy, makers of the best premium socks I've ever owned. And Dead Soxy has another deal for our podcast listeners. Dead Soxy welcomes you to the pre-Cyber 2022 sale. Buy more and save more. The more you spend, the more you save. So stock up on gifts, stocking stuffers, and don't forget a little something for yourself. Get 25% off any order using code LUCKY, L-U-C-K-Y, at DeadSoxy.com. But it doesn't stop there. If you spend $50 or more on that order, you get free shipping. If you spend $120 or more, you get 30% off. And if you stack so many socks that you spend $240 or more, you get 40% off. That's a lot of socks and a lot of savings. As I've told you before, Dead Soxy offers a premium product made from bamboo that gives you that luxury feel on your feet. Their patented technology has a no-slip guarantee that prevents the socks from rolling down your leg. And those socks have truly become a part of my weekly game day routine. And the navy and gold product line has been a real hit with Inside Indy Sports podcast listeners. So stock your sock drawers and have a wonderful holiday season. As always, stay soxy. Notre Dame dominated for the most part of the first half on Saturday. Then the midshipmen dominated the Irish for much of the second half. In a season filled with weird games, Notre Dame managed to produce another one worthy of the top shelf this past weekend. But at least for the Irish, this one came in a victory. Now the attention this week shifts to Boston College for the final home game of the season. That means several Notre Dame players will be playing their last game in Notre Dame Stadium on Saturday. We wanted to get a sense for what awaits those players as NFL prospects, so we reached out to Mike Renner, lead draft analyst for Pro Football Focus and a Notre Dame alum, to download some knowledge. Mike, thanks for joining us.
For sure. Thanks for having me on. Always an honor.
Mike, before we start getting into your evaluations of Notre Dame's players, can you share with our listeners how you sort of got into your role as a draft analyst for Pro Football Focus? What led you to that path from Notre Dame?
Yeah, so I was actually an accounting major at Notre Dame. I was accounting and computer applications, and then knew I didn't want to do accounting. And PFF back then, that was a decade ago. I was class of 2012 Notre Dame. So a decade ago, PFF, like, we were lucky to get mentions in newspapers and mentions in articles. Like, people didn't know much about it. I was one of the first 10 employees there. They just needed people to help do data collection for them. So I was thinking, I'm like, I could either go get my MBA, which was what I was planning on doing, or I could take this part-time job at this fledgling company and see if it turns into anything. A decade later, here I am. So it's been a fun ride, and I've been doing draft pretty much only for the last 5 years now, and seen a fair number of Notre Dame prospects come through. Some misses on my part, Notre Dame prospects, but obviously know them all fairly well.
Well, Mike, where I wanted to kind of start with is more big picture with not only the senior class, but maybe some of the draft eligible juniors. I think going into this year, I thought this draft class would be bigger, and maybe your evaluations will take us there. It just seems like there's some pretty obvious guys, and then you get to gray area pretty quickly. Overall, how do you see the roster?
Yeah, I think they'll have a number of guys drafted. The thing is, are they going to be drafted highly? Do they have blue chip guys? Like, is there a Kyle Hamilton on this team right now? I don't think so. I think they could have one first rounder in Isaiah Foskey. It's like your only guy that could get to that point, but he has not. I don't think he's had the year he wanted coming back. You know, he has definitely not, I'd say, raised his stock. His stock's probably at best the same as it was prior to this season in the NFL's eyes with his play this year. So I think they'll have a number of guys drafted. It just may be a lot of guys on day three, I'd say.
And when you were saying one first rounder, you mean among the seniors, not including Michael Mayer?
Yes. Yeah. No, yeah, among the seniors, among that group that you're talking about.
So speaking of Michael Mayer, how high could he go if he chooses to go in the NFL draft? Is he that good? I know tight ends not a lot of tight ends go in the first round. Is he a good enough tight end to push for a high draft pick?
I think he is. It's tough though. Tight end's a tough position because some teams just won't take a guy that high and some teams will. You know, like Cal Pitts goes number 4 overall, TJ Hockenson goes number 8 overall. Two very different types of tight ends where your last two top 10 picks at tight ends. But the vast majority of tight ends that do go in the first round run somewhere in the neighborhood of 4.6 or below in the 40. Michael Mayer, I think we can all agree, is not going to. In his speed, athleticism, that's not his game. But everything else about the position, he's about as good as it gets. So if you just take the speed out of the equation, you have a ready-made NFL player. My comp for him is Jason Witten, and it's like, it's too good of a comp. That is who he's going to be at the NFL level. He's going to be that, the chain mover, the inline blocker, the guy that you could just rely upon to do that game after game, snap after snap. And then it comes to putting a valuation on that. Some teams will value that as a top 10, top 15 pick. Some teams, that's not a role in their offense. They don't really care. They won't even put a first round grade or wouldn't even touch that guy in the first round just because they don't need that in their offense. So I do ultimately think he goes probably somewhere in the top 20 picks. I think he could go as high as the top 10 to 12. But again, it's really going to be a team specific fit when you're talking about the tight end position. It's not like a pass rusher where every team in the NFL needs a pass rusher. You know, every team could draft one of the top 10. You really only have a few teams who are like, yeah, that's a tight end. That's a guy I need in my offense.
Mike, I'm curious, when you watch games, do you kind of scan the roster for pro prospects? I mean, can you watch games like that, or how do you process that? And where I'm getting to is when you watch Notre Dame versus Clemson, Notre Dame versus Ohio State, and when we watch Notre Dame versus USC, how do the overall talent level compare?
I think they're on fairly equal footing, you know, from a pro prospect perspective. Now, they might not have it at the same positions that may impact the game as much as some of those teams. Like, they don't have a Caleb Williams, you know, when you're going up against USC, who's going to be probably a top 5 pick, not 2023, but 2024, because he's only a sophomore. But they don't have that guy at that position who's, you know, the true difference maker this season, I'd say. You know, when your best player is a tight end, again, that's not a position that routinely is the needle mover on an offense. You know, you'd rather have the quarterback, you'd rather have the elite edge rusher, you'd rather have the elite wide receiver. You know, those positions impact every single play to some degree. So, but just from a pure total talent, how many of those guys are going to the NFL that are starting right now? I think Notre Dame's up there with a lot of the best programs in the country, maybe only behind, you know, the true people who have been there in the playoffs year in, year out, the Georgias, the Alabamas. But there's not a lot of guys who are multi-year starters on this team that will not be playing in the NFL, which is, that's where you got to get as a you know, program, right? That's what all the top programs, if you're starting for them, you're probably going to be a future NFL player. That's where Notre Dame has to get. And I think they're close to that right now.
And then just following up on that, I know that you're probably looking at the draft eligible guys, but when you're watching Notre Dame, can you take your eyes off of guys like Joe Alt and Blake Fisher who are not draft eligible? And what's your impression of those two?
Yeah, that's the thing, is watching Notre Dame's offense, it's almost tough because I'm just watching Joe Alt. He's unbelievable. He's blowing my mind with how good he is at his age. It's reminiscent of, you know, Penei Sewell back when he was at Oregon. His sophomore year was the last year we saw him actually at Oregon. And it was just, I don't know how a guy that young is that good already. And it just makes you think, what's he going to be in the future? Because there's not really much that he's putting on tape that's, you know, negative. So you're watching a game and it's just, it's going up against a Miles Murphy, who's probably gonna be a top 10 pick for Clemson a few weeks back, and just shutting him out, you know, just a clean slate there. So yeah, Joe Alt's tough to, you know, not put your eyes on snap after snap. And I will say Blake Fisher, I watched him a lot. His growth from week one this season, Ohio State, week two, Marshall, where, man, he struggled so much against Marshall. And I was watching that tape back because I was just, you know, going back and actually reviewing the All 22 for some of the prospects. And I'm like, Blake Fisher, like, he looked better as a freshman in that one half against Florida State than he did this game against Marshall. And I'm like, what just happened? And obviously, you're switching sides, but man, he has settled in. And I wouldn't put him, he's not close to how I feel about Alt right now. I think Alt's going to be a top 5 to 10 pick when he does come out. But you see it. Like, you see the ability that under Harry Hiestand's tutelage, it's going to come at some point. He's going to be that guy, and he's really improved.
Yeah, Alt's fascinating because, I mean, he was mostly a high school tight end, and there are lots of success stories of high school tight ends who became really good college offensive linemen and then end up being really, really good NFL linemen. I wonder if it's worth, like, teams should maybe start taking high school tight ends and making them into offensive linemen more frequently, because it seems to be, I mean, obviously there's plenty that don't turn out too, but it seems like there's a high ceiling for those kinds of guys.
Oh yeah. I joke, and I'm not really even joke, every year there's probably two or three tight ends who are, you know, fringe fifth, sixth, seventh rounders who can block, where I'm like, if they just ate, you know, fat and protein for, you know, 5,000 calories every day for the next 6 months and put on muscle, like, because half of, and not half of, but a good portion of playing the tackle position is just, can you move and can you use your hands to be able to stay in front of 240-pound guys that run 4.4s? You know, like, can you do that? Because once you can, your life is a lot easier than the guys who can't. And so a lot of tight ends who maybe aren't even considered athletic for tight ends, once they put on, you know, 30, 40 pounds like Joe Walt and become, you know, a tackle, they're athletic for tackles. So yeah, it's something that definitely from a recruiting perspective, you're going to want, if guys are tight ends, jumbo tight ends in high school that look like they can move, I'd be moving a lot of those guys off of the tackle.
That's interesting. You know, we talk about Foskey and we talk about Mayer, and then we kind of get into the next tier of Notre Dame prospects. And there's two guys that really intrigue me. Jarrett Patterson, who changed positions, who's been playing with a sprained foot since August, in pain, has to, you know, wear a walking boot usually the day after games. And then Brandon Joseph, who transfers from Northwestern, hoping to become a first round caliber prospect, or at least a high round draft choice. How do you feel like their journeys this year are playing out?
Yeah, Patterson really playing through injury. Obviously, it's something that you want to do as a player, and that for, you know, to help the team, you feel good about doing. But from a pro prospect's perspective, you're doing yourself no favors. It is not helping to play through injury and put on probably, I'd say, worse tape than what we saw last year, et cetera. Now it's good for his pro prospects to show he can play multiple positions. And at his size, I always thought that was going to be the case, that he could be guard, center, guard, three position versatility on the interior. But you can tell that he is not 100% out there compared to what he put on tape last year. So I thought he was probably, you know, in the range of where Robert Hainsey went. So a late day two guy coming into this season. And obviously with the foot, that is going to, depending on how it heals and whatever, the medical tests, rechecks at the combine and whatnot, assuming a clean bill of health, I don't think he's going to go any higher than that. I don't think he's improved upon that, just because it's difficult to when you're playing through injury. So no team's going to look at his tape and say, really go to bat for it. Obviously you go to bat for his toughness and whatnot and the player and the mentality, but I still think he's probably in that late day two to somewhere in the mid day three range.
And how about Brandon Joseph?
Brandon Joseph, I'm a big fan of. I've seen differing sort of opinions on him, a lot revolving kind of around him as a tackler and what, like, he can bring to the table. And is he just this, you know, the new wave of defenses in the NFL? They're taking safeties and making them more slot corners and making them more deep coverage players, not really caring about what they do in run defense. And that was always the type of player he was at Northwestern. He was not your box safety. Let's get him in and mix it up at the line of scrimmage sort of guy. But I thought he's improved a lot as a tackler this year. He just looks much more confident coming into contact than what I saw at Northwestern, which was, again, the biggest sort of worry with him. And I love his coverage abilities. I'm probably higher on him than most. I think I have him as a top 75 player on the PFF board. I just think that he has that natural playmaking ability, the uncoachable part of the safety position that reminds me of like a Micah Hyde, where, you know, Micah Hyde coming out of Iowa and even with the Packers and the Bills, there's nothing you rave about physically with the guy. I think that's the same with like Joseph. There's no one trait that he can hang his hat on where it's, you know, his range isn't elite. His sort of his burst isn't elite. His size isn't elite. He's just kind of a guy in that regard. But the way he plays the game is so, so fast and so much faster than he's probably going to test. So I go to bat for the guy. I think he could be a second rounder, but the way the NFL is devaluing safeties, the way kind of the position's been drafted. Wouldn't surprise me if he ends up on day three, but I feel pretty good that he's going to be somewhere in the day two conversation when it's all said and done.
I wanted to circle back to Isaiah Foskey. What did you want or feel like he needed to show this season, and where has he maybe come up short in terms of maybe trying to raise his stock this year?
So he's an elite athlete, right? He's been, I think, two-time Bruce Feldman Freaks List guy. And you watch sort of his high-end reps and the power and explosiveness at his size, and you're like, damn, that could be, you know, that could be Marcus Davenport for the Saints. That could be this this pocket pusher, this bull rusher at the next level. That's just a sort of a snap in, a snap out sort of problem. He's just going to move the line, reset the line of scrimmage in the run game. He's going to push the pocket against the pass. It's just a guy who can be consistent because of that physical ability. But why has it not translated? You know, when you have that physical edge, why is it not really translated to collegiate tackles who realistically should have a massive physical edge over it? And you really just don't see the consistency in his bull rush technique, in his ability to sink into contact and really reset that makes you think once he gets to the NFL that he's going to be able to do that against NFL. Because he's still, and you know, after 4 years, and obviously Marcus Freeman's scheme, I wouldn't say is the most pass rusher friendly in terms of giving you opportunities to go one-on-one. It's not, you know, he's not getting what, you know, the Ohio State guys get in terms of one-on-one and freedom to rush the passer. But even still, I still think he's just a little too hot and cold. And especially when you saw him against some better competition, namely week one, Ohio State was obviously going to be the best tackle duo we faced all season. I just think he came up a little short of where I would have hoped if I'm drafting that guy. And it's just expectations, right? Are you drafting that guy top 10 to 15? Or are you drafting that guy 25 to 50? And I think he's probably fallen more towards the 25 to 50 range than the 10 to 15 after his play.
Mike, who would be in then the next tier down from the Brandon Josephs and Jarrett Pattersons? Like, I'm thinking about the Adam Alola twins, Josh Lugg, Tariq Bracey. Who intrigues you among them? Are those all draftable players?
I think Cam Hart is probably the next one who intrigues me.
Okay.
Because of size, length at the cornerback position. Yeah, it's like size, length, speed. That's a lot of – that's cornerback play at the NFL level because you're going to be behind guys. It's like you're going to have to make up for it somehow. And size is the way to do it. Speed's the way to do it. And so if you have those things at that position, I think it gives you a leg up. So obviously I don't think he's been shut down by any means. I don't think he's had probably the year he wanted in terms of really raising his stock. But I do think that the NFL is always going to bet on those guys at some point in draft. You'd rather take that guy than the 5'9", 180-pound corner who's playing maybe good football, but at the next level is just going to get sunned at the catch point every time. So, yeah, I think he's at least put himself in the – he's going to get drafted. Where exactly? Probably somewhere early day three, I'd say, at this point.
In terms of the Adam Ola twins, is there a clear difference between who would be a better draft prospect, whether Jason as a defensive tackle or Justin as a defensive end?
I honestly keep having to, every time I like watch the defensive line, I keep having to look back and be like, okay, which one was that again? And that's my fault for not being, you know.
Well, to be fair, I've covered them in person for 5 years now. And Justin came into the post-game press conference after the game in Vegas. And I was like, that's not Jason. I thought they were playing a prank on us, and I was like, wait a minute, which one is this? But it was actually Justin. So you're not alone. So don't worry about it.
No, but those two, I just don't think when you're at that kind of size, which is kind of the same boat as, who was the last year? Tagovailoa Mosa last year, where it's just, you're not meeting kind of the traits threshold in terms of, you know, Jason's an undersized DT. Justin's a shorter defensive end. A lot of teams are going to shy away from that because of the developmental potential in their eyes when you don't have the length, when you don't have the size strength for your respective position, it's just going to be lower. So, you know, they performed well. Obviously, I think they're both having solid years for themselves, but I don't think it's going to get them onto draft radars just because of that, just because the NFL still traits-based, unless you're, you know, elite performer at the collegiate level, which I wouldn't put them in that category.
So Justin has a year of eligibility left if he wanted to come back. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that he will, but say if he did and then becomes the starting Viper and plays that role that Isaiah Foskey's been playing, could he do enough to get himself in position like that, or is it just, will it still probably come back to those trades regardless?
I think so. I do think he has probably the athleticism to get there, and obviously then you're going to have to put something on tape. You're going to have to really perform to that level to get there. But, it, you know, never going to count a guy out who has that, you know, is in that conversation already.
So this weekend, Boston College comes to town. Phil Dracovic comes back to Notre Dame Stadium as a glorified cheerleader because he's got concussion issues, knee issues, back issues. So he's not going to play. I'm wondering, given, you know, the tough year he's had, and he's on a team that's the worst running team in the country and one of the worst offensive lines, but what's your sense of where he would land if he came out this year? What's your sense of maybe if he needs to jump in the portal again and find a new home and maybe rebuild his reputation? How do you feel like that dynamic will and should play out?
I think he should come back to school. Truthfully, he's going to be fighting for a practice squad if he does that. I'd be hard-pressed to see him get drafted. And obviously, he is in a situation where not a lot of quarterbacks are going to succeed there. It's not a lot of talent around him at BC. But you still have to rise above it at some point. He really just obviously did not this year before, as you mentioned, the concussion issues. So that would be, if I were, you know, giving him advice, that's what I would say, because I think we've seen the trend of what you see with Hendon Hooker this year, with Stetson Bennett this year, two guys who are going to get drafted a lot higher than they would have had they come out last year. If Stetson Bennett probably wouldn't even gotten drafted had he come out last year, but they're 24 years old. You know, the NFL doesn't really care when you play well at quarterback. They just care if you play well. So if, you know, he comes back for, I think it'd be year six, right? Year six yeah. for him. And all of a sudden turns it on, lights it up. He'll get drafted. You know, he will go high then because he is talented physically. And he is 6'5". He does have a fairly big arm and is a plus athlete. So yeah, that's what I would recommend. But again, with what he's put on tape this year, he's not going to get drafted. I'd be hard pressed to see that.
Mike, sort of in that same vein, because Notre Dame, I think, will be interested in looking at a grad transfer quarterback, and you're evaluating some of these guys that are maybe borderline draft, making decisions to go into the draft or deciding to stay. Are there guys that come to mind as people that Notre Dame should pursue as quarterbacks that you think would be worth pursuing as borderline draft guys that maybe come back to school for another year and decide to grad transfer to Notre Dame to give it one more run?
Yeah, the one guy I keep coming back to that I've had people tell me to tell him, because I actually interviewed him on our podcast and I've had a few conversations with him, is Tanner McKee, the Stanford quarterback. As okay. I've had some of my Notre Dame buddies like, dude, tell him to come to Notre Dame. And if he goes out this year, he'd probably be a top 50 pick, top 75 pick. He'd go like at worst where Davis Mills went, because I think he's that caliber of a quarterback in terms of what he showed from accuracy and just obviously physical talent. But man, that Stanford offense, I mean, I was at the Stanford Notre Dame game, is hard to watch. That was a rough game overall, obviously, because Notre Dame's side as well, but they do not do him any favors. They are not scheming guys open, and they do not have talent on the outside. I think I pulled his, you know, we do quarterback charting here at PFF, and I pulled his contested or tight window throws 10 plus yards down the field, rate of throws that are tight window. I think he was in the five highest of all quarterbacks in the country in terms of how infrequently guys are open for him. It was twice, a 10-yard throw for him was twice as likely to be into a tight window as Bryce Young, as CJ Stroud, as these other top wow. quarterbacks in the draft, where it's just like he's playing a different game with how kind of dated that Stanford offense is. And so super physically talented, you know, former highly recruited guy, but Stanford, you know, under David Shaw is just not going to showcase quarterbacks in the modern college football landscape. They're just not doing the things that you need to do to scheme guys open. And so obviously Notre Dame's going to be a little bit better than that. And obviously there's a little bit more coming back than probably Stanford does. So that's the one guy I'd keep going back to. I'm like, if he wants to come back to school, and he had said to me that like Stanford, he went there in the first place because academics were so important to him. Right. That's the one guy I'd keep an eye on.
Okay. My last question for you is kind of out of your lane. So if this is too far out of your comfort zone, let me know, but when you watch Tommy Rees as a play caller, as an offensive coordinator, as a quarterback's coach, do you feel like his future is more NFL-ish? Do you see him as a college head coach someday, or do you feel like he's still got a lot to prove in either arena?
So that's what I was kind of upset about early in the season, was I thought Tommy Rees was almost trying to debut for an NFL offense coordinator position. Like, I thought the offense he was running was not kind of taking advantage of what makes college football unique and how you can put up points in college football that you can't necessarily do at the NFL level. Like, he was running pretty much all NFL concepts almost, you know, in the running game and with the two tight end stuff. And I was just like, you're trying to kind of square peg a round hole here with, you know, you kind of got to take advantage of some of the low hanging fruit that the wide hash marks offer, that differences in the collegiate game offers. And the biggest thing that I will say is he is made improvements week on week. Like, you see him changing up his offense to do so. If it was still around the same stuff they were back, you know, Ohio State game, Marshall game, I'd probably call him for his head at this point, but you've seen the changes. So I've been very impressed with that. I do think they are doing a lot of different stuff, especially with their shifts and motions, and a lot more to simplify it for their quarterback when they knew the quarterback was going to be a little bit of an issue heading into the season. So hats off to him. But I do still think, you know, going back to that, he's probably still gunning for an NFL OC job, because that's what it looked like he was doing early on. So I think that's where he has his eyes, if he is looking anywhere.
All right, Mike. Well, that's all we have for you. We really appreciate you taking time to join us. I know basically all year is draft season anymore, but you're going to be ramping up here for a pretty busy time of the year. So best of luck with all of that.
For sure, fellas. Thanks so much for having me on. Go Irish.
And where can people find your content and so forth?
You can find me on Twitter at @PFF_Mike. I'll have a draft guide out after the Senior Bowl, week after the Senior Bowl, on PFF.com. And you can tune in. We do a show on YouTube weekly, daily, Monday through Friday, 11 a.m. Eastern. It's called It's Just Football. It's on the PFF YouTube channel. Every Wednesday is our draft day. And so tomorrow, I guess Wednesday, whenever it's coming out, we will be doing draft talk, mock drafts, that sort of thing. So make sure to check that out as well.
Awesome. Really appreciate it, Mike.
For sure, fellas. Thanks.
As a reminder, the Inside Indy Sports podcast is presented by Dead Soxy, maker of the best dress socks you'll ever wear. And if you're like me, fighting the crowds, looking for deals on holiday gifts is something I try to avoid. What's the alternative? Check out what our friends at Dead Soxy have going this week. It's their pre-Cyber 2022 sale. What does that mean? Buy more, save more. Here's how the math works. Any order using the promo code LUCKY, that's L-U-C-K-Y, LUCKY, is going to get you 25% off on your order. If you spend at least $50, you get free shipping with that. But you get 30% off any order of $120 or more, and 40% off any order of $240 or more. And all of that comes with free shipping. So make your holiday shopping fun and easy, and even treat yourself. Remember, all their socks come with a patented technology with a no-slip guarantee, made from bamboo for that premium luxury feel. So head to deadsoxy.com. That's deadsoxy.com, and check out the navy and gold collection. Click on the collections tab, select team colorways from the drop-down menu, and then once you find the socks that you like, use promo code LUCKY.
All right, now it's time for questions. Our question segment is powered by AcrePro Midwest Farm Group. When it comes to land sales, it pays to have experts in your corner. AcrePro Midwest Farm Group are your local farmland specialists. With decades of experience in Indiana agriculture, no one knows the market better. Whether you're doing a 1031 exchange or simply buying and selling farmland, your local AcrePro agent will walk the land with you and ensure the deal is done right. Visit AcrePro.com or call 765-587-3185 and talk to your local land expert today. Again, 765-587-3185. You can submit questions to us on Twitter or the Insider Lounge message board before every podcast. I'm at TJamesND and Eric's at EHansonND. First one I have for us, Eric, is from at Cubster11. 2023 quarterback recruit versus grad transfer? Is there a benefit to one over the other? And how does that affect wide receiver recruiting in the next two cycles?
Well, can it be both? I mean, if I had to make a choice between the two, I would take the grad transfer over the 2023. But it looks like Notre Dame can have its cake and eat it too in this cycle. It looks like they're going to get Kenny Minchie from Hendersonville, Tennessee, who was committed to Pitt. And then there's going to be a pretty good array of grad transfer talent that could end up at Notre Dame. And Mike Renner just mentioned, Tanner McKee from Stanford is somebody that might be a nice fit. As far as how would that either of those influence wide receiver recruiting, well, you've already got three top 250 receivers and a pretty good chance of adding another really good receiver in this class based on no 2023 receiver and no promise of a grad transfer. And I think that's based on Marcus Freeman's vision and Tommy Reese's, to a certain extent, vision of the future of the Notre Dame offense and being able to sell what that's going to look like, and then having a commitment from CJ Carr. I mean, CJ's been at a lot of these big recruiting weekends where he's been talking to recruits and so forth. I would imagine Cam Williams and CJ, there's a connection there already, and Cam's in the 2024 class. So I think that's going to influence recruits more. And again, the promise of what Notre Dame's offense is going to look like, because what it looks like now is not a big selling point to wide receivers. If anything, I think it makes it a tougher sell.
Yeah. I do think, to me, these are like the issues that these are solving are different. Like a grad transfer quarterback is being brought in to play next season. Whereas I never believed, like, once the Dante Moore boat sailed away, that Notre Dame was getting a 2023 quarterback that would come in to compete for the starter next season. And even that might be asking a lot for Dante Moore to come in and be the 2023 starter. So,
well, given what's asked of the quarterback here in this offense, making those adjustments to the line of scrimmage and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, although I think they've taken that off the plate with the scan offense. That was the whole idea of it. Even though maybe people don't agree with it, but I think it's actually probably helped more than it's hurt, even though people have sort of glommed onto it just because it has a name for it. I think sometimes when things get a name and it's mentioned on a broadcast, then they have something to point at and blame. But anyways, that's a tangent for another day. I think the 2023 quarterback and 2024 quarterback recruiting will probably have a bigger impact on wide receiver recruiting. Because, I mean, if you look at what Notre Dame's wide receiver recruiting now, it's already going well, and they don't have a lot to like look at in terms of on the field, in terms of this is what you could be at Notre Dame. This is what the offense looks like in terms of being a high flying offense. So I do think a grad transfer that plays well next season could help that. But obviously that quarterback's not going to be playing with those recruits in the future anyway. So, but I do think it would be helpful to sort of see that and see Chancey Stuckey turn some guys into playmakers with the help of a good quarterback throwing the ball to them. All right. We received a number of similar questions this week. So I combined two from Enforcers 2117 and at Mike DeVoy 1. If Notre Dame gets a commitment from Kenny Minchie, who Eric mentioned previously, do they still go after a transfer who can compete for the starting job?
Absolutely. Because Kenny Minchie isn't going to be in the mix to start in 2023. Notre Dame needs to create, either bring somebody that is going to be the starter or is so good it lifts Tyler Buchner up to another level. I mean, that's really the scenarios. I don't think Drew Pine is realistic option in the 2023 picture, but he's proven people wrong before. But I really think you're either going to have a grad transfer starting in 2023 or Tyler Buchner playing at such a high level that he beats that person out.
Yeah. To me, the 2023 quarterback doesn't change the math. and who the grad transfer would impact would be Drew Pine and Tyler Buchner, and it's not necessarily impacting Steve Angeli or Kenny Minchie or CJ Carr. So I still think that should be on Notre Dame's.
Or Ron Paulus.
Or Ron Paulus the third, because I do think Notre Dame should try to get as much competition in that quarterback room in terms of someone who could start next season. Mike from at KYND fan asked chances of ND landing Kenny Minchie, which Eric already sort of indicated what he thought about that.
Well, I think that our recruiting guy, Kyle Kelly, has put in a future cast for that. That's the anticipation that it's a very, very good chance. I mean, he would not have decommitted from Pitt if he didn't have Notre Dame in his sights. And so I do think that that will happen sooner than later.
Yeah, it seems like there's pretty good chances that's how it ends up. I would still say, like, given the way quarterback recruiting has played out this cycle, I have to see them cross the finish line to feel 100% confident in that. I guess to sort of categorize it, I would say that Notre Dame has a better chance with Kenny Minchie now than it's had with any of the quarterbacks it's been recruiting since Dante Moore.
It's going to be 29 degrees at Notre Dame Stadium on Saturday, but it's going to be 29 in Pittsburgh too. So he's not going to go, oh my gosh, it's cold weather.
Yeah, you don't have to worry about the weather concerns there because he was already committed to a cold weather school. All right, next question is from at Henry Bede. There's a chance that Notre Dame gets a transfer quarterback commitment before ND plays its bowl game. Do you think that would affect Drew Pine's decision whether to play in the bowl game, or do you think Pine will stick around through spring practice and fight to be QB1?
I'm not sure why he would drop out of a bowl game because a grad transfer was committed. I don't know that that does him any good. It's not like he's preserving himself for the pros. And if he were going to transfer himself, he would have plenty of time to do that in the couple weeks that follow the bowl game. So I don't see him dropping out because of that. I think these are kind of two separate questions. Do you think he would stay for the spring semester and battle it out? Yeah, I do. I think unless the coaching staff specifically told him that you don't have a chance to win this, then I think he goes away. And Charlie Weiss did that one year. He did it one summer with Zach Frazier. They had a four-way knockout in the spring for the starting quarterback. And then afterwards, Zach Frazier wanted to stay and continue to compete. And Charlie told him to transfer. So he ended up going to UConn and then coming back and beating Notre Dame. Which is kind of interesting.
What class was he? What grade was he when that happened? Was he a senior?
I believe he was. He had gone through his freshman year, so maybe freshman to sophomore.
Oh, so he was young. Okay.
Yeah, he was young. It was Demetrius Jones and Evan Sharpley and Jimmy Clausen. So I think he was in the class right before Clausen. Clausen was an early enrolled freshman who had an elbow injury. So, Charlie was like, see ya. But I don't think the Notre Dame staff would do that. I mean, they could be honest with him and say, hey, look, you're going to be the third option probably here. But, Drew Pine is a fighter. I mean, he's been told he's not good enough all his life. So I don't think that would deter him. Now, after spring, if he ends up the third option, then I think, he would have to give some thought. And I think he's pretty far ahead in his classwork. He would want to leave with that Notre Dame degree. I don't see him wanting to transfer before he had that in hand.
I would say the doubters came to Pine later in the process than early. I mean, he got an offer as an eighth grader from Alabama. That's true. So I think he was probably feeling pretty good about himself back then. But his physical maturation didn't necessarily continue in the same way in terms of getting the height that many quarterbacks want to get. Yeah, I mean, beyond that, he loves Notre Dame. Like, he this was his dream to come to Notre Dame and play football. And I would be surprised if he left Notre Dame before he graduated. I don't know how quickly he can do that. He's a junior. I think, in theory, if he's on track for that, maybe he can graduate in the summer. And that puts him in a position to get his degree from Notre Dame and also transfer if that's what he wants to do. But I would be a bit surprised if he didn't stick at Notre Dame through the spring, because that would likely mean, unless for some reason he's on pace to graduate in December, that he would be leaving Notre Dame before he would graduate. And I don't know that he would do that, because he, say even like he goes in the spring knowing that he probably wants to transfer but wants to graduate first, you still would need, it still helps to be in practice and compete, and maybe things go your way and you do prove yourself and continue to show improvement. So I think Notre Dame is Drew Pine's first and second choice, in my opinion. So I don't know that he's going to be in a hurry to try to get out of here, and he will fight to try and hold on to the starting job that he has right now. And also circling back, I think it would be a bit, what are your thoughts, like getting a transfer commitment before ND plays in a bowl game? Do you think that would be likely?
I don't think it's likely. I think they might start talking to people, and then, sure. Yeah, I mean, because there's going to be a few guys, let's say it was Tanner McKee. Stanford's not playing in a bowl game, so he may start taking some visits in December.
Yeah, well, and he would also be in the process of deciding if he's going to the NFL or not too, so he would need to probably make that decision sooner rather than later. Also, like, I mean, I think probably any transfer quarterback wants to get here for the spring to compete to be the starter anyway, so it would be similar to Jack Cohn's situation. All right, next question is from at Sully Fenton. Well, I think our last quarterback-related question for the podcast today, at least in terms of the recruiting front, how different do you think Tommy Reese's offense is going to look with CJ Carr / Kenny Minchie at quarterback?
Well, if it's still, you know, Tommy Reese's offense by then, Tommy Reese may not be here, but let's assume that he is. I mean, Tommy Reese will tailor the offense to what his personnel is. And by the time one of those guys might be the starter, they're trending very well with wide receivers. You know, this offense is not wide receiver friendly because there's not many wide receivers on it.
Worth being friends with.
Yeah. Some of them aren't very good or are very young and will be good, but haven't reached that point yet. So I think Tommy envisions this offense as being something that will still have the staples of really good tight ends, really good offensive line play, really good running backs, but they can have the bells and whistles of the really good wide receivers. I think that's the direction it's heading, and that's whether it's Tommy Reese or whoever his successor is.
Yeah, Tommy Reese already does so many different things with the offense that I think it won't look different in its makeup. It would just look sort of like different in what is it's successful doing. Like it would, in theory, if it can take more chances down the field in the passing game, it would do that more frequently, and the plays that are missed more often than not right now would be successful and then attempted more because they can be successful doing that. So I do think he would tailor it around their strengths, but I think he's shown the ability to run all kinds of different personnel groupings out there, do a lot of different kinds of concepts, which maybe doesn't necessarily help Notre Dame at all always. But I think
It excites Dan Orlovsky.
It does excite Dan Orlovsky. He is a leader of the Tommy Reese fan club. And sometimes I think Dan Orlovsky is looking at through an NFL lens and expecting Notre Dame's quarterbacks to be playing and executing the offense as if they are NFL quarterbacks. And certainly that's not really the case right now. But yeah, I mean, I just think it'll be, it can be more dynamic potentially. I mean, we're projecting that those guys actually turn out to be really good players. So you never really know, but I think that would be the goal. Next question is from Jeff Staley at J.E. Staley 01. When it comes to criticism, why does Al Golden seem to get a pass compared to Tommy Reese? The defense has regressed this year and Golden had more talent to work with than Tommy did on the offense.
Well, I don't know if he means criticism from fans or criticism from media or both. I would say Al Golden's got some criticism, but let me throw some numbers at you to show you maybe why it's harsher for Tommy Reese. One is Notre Dame right now is 78th in total offense. They're 26th nationally in total defense. So that's a big difference. Mm. They were 45th in total offense last year. The last time they were worse than 78th in total offense was 2007. That's when Notre Dame went 3-9. Charlie's third year, they were 119th that year. And in total defense, Notre Dame is actually better than they were last year. They're not better in scoring defense, but in total defense, they were 43rd. They're 26th this year. And so I think there's some other factors too. You know, the defense is third scheme in third year, third coordinator in third 3 years. You know, the offense has been Tommy Reese's the last 3 years. Tommy has had a hand in developing and recruiting the players on offense. Al Golden really hasn't had that. So I think, you know, fairly or unfairly, Tommy Reese gets criticized in more ways. And then there's still people that remember Tommy as a player, right, and kind of hold that against him too. So I think, you know, Al Golden was definitely the better player of those two, although he played for Penn State.
I don't know that how many Notre Dame fans have a recollection of Al Golden's playing career, but they certainly know plenty about Tommy Reese's, and I do think that plays some of a role, and they're just obviously they're more familiar with him. I think anytime you're familiar with a coach for that long and you're not like winning national championships, you're gonna get tired of a guy maybe throw more blame his way than it's deserved. But like you said, Reese's offense has been worse than Golden's defense. I don't think there's really any argument to be made on that front. Look at the two games that Notre Dame sort of needed to win to revive its season, Syracuse and Clemson. Those games were won because of the defense. It wasn't because of what the offense did. Yes, the offense ran the ball really well against Clemson, but if Notre Dame's defense didn't play the way it did, Notre Dame could have lost that game. I mean, Notre Dame's defense scored 7 points on its own and put Notre Dame in position to score another one with an interception that was close to the end zone as well. So,
and they also got a blocked punt for a touchdown.
Right. And the defense also gave Notre Dame a chance to beat Ohio State. I mean, we forget that because it was so long ago, but like the reason that Notre Dame was in that game is because Notre Dame's defense played really well. I also think like if we're looking at the regression, there are some numbers that Notre Dame's defense has regressed in terms of passing efficiency defense and rushing defense. And like you mentioned, scoring defense, I would attribute some of the scoring defense to Notre Dame's offense not being as good and putting Notre Dame's defense in bad positions. And Notre Dame's also played some pretty good quarterbacks this year. I think we may not think about that, but CJ Stroud and Drake May are probably both better than Desmond Ridder and Sam Howell were last year as the two best quarterbacks that Notre Dame played against last year. So I think you have to sort of keep that in mind. And DJ Uiagalelei certainly didn't play well, but I still think he's a fairly good quarterback and probably better than anyone else. He was
the number one player in the country coming out. Now he hasn't been that guy in college.
Right, but he's still probably better than the third best quarterback Notre Dame played last year is probably Tanner McKee, who they played again this year. But then after that, I would say that DJ would be probably next in that pecking order. But I think that's why Tommy Reese is criticized more, because they haven't produced as well yet. And the talent that is on Notre Dame's offense, Tommy Reese takes some of the blame for that because he was here to recruit those players, whereas Al Golden was just given the players that he was given. So if there's deficiencies in terms of the personnel, Al Golden's not going to and fit Al Golden. I mean, that's not necessarily Al Golden's fault. Now, obviously, the idea is that he coaches those guys up and coaches around them to put them in the best position. But I think all those things sort of combine to why Tommy Reese gets more of the blame than Al Golden does. All right. Next question. Speaking of Al Golden, is from Marie Biafore at Biafore_Marie. And I feel like we've talked about this question before. I wanted to see if this is something similar had been sent to us. How would you grade Al Golden's adjustment to the college game? Does his play calling put his players in the best positions to be successful moving forward? Do you see Freeman being more involved with the defense or possibly analyst hired in the off season to help?
Well, Marie is, I would have thought if I didn't know better, I know what Marie does for a living and it's amazing, but I would have thought she was a teacher because she does ask us for grades a lot. I would give Al Golden a B, and I base that on improvement. You know, I think The Marshall game was his worst game. Marshall's turned out to be a really good defensive team and a really bad offensive team. They can run the ball. They can't throw the ball. They can't protect. And Notre Dame didn't take advantage of that in the Marshall game. So they should have never gotten to 26 points. But the Syracuse game, the Clemson game were really good. I think there were some mitigating circumstances in the Navy game, including some injuries that under different circumstances, that's a different game. So B for him. As far as analysts and, adding analysts and Marcus Freeman being more involved, let's take the analysts first. You know, what they're going to be able to do is provide data to help him make decisions and to help him do better. And Marcus Freeman, when I asked him about adding analysts to either side of the ball, he seemed to be very open to having a larger staff of that if that's something that's going to make them better. I almost think, Marie, you're implying Marcus's involvement is needed to help Al Golden. I don't know that that's necessarily the case. I do think that Marcus will probably reevaluate after the season how he wants to spend his time during the week, during the falls, and how much, where he spends his time on game day decisions and game day thoughts and so forth. I don't know that he's going to move off too far from where he is right now. He wants to be heavily involved in special teams. He wants to continue to learn about the offense to be a better head coach. So I think he hired a defensive coordinator that he trusts, and that's going to get the job done. And I think Al Golden, if he's on the staff next year, will be a better defensive coordinator, just another year back in the college game. When I transcribe him and I interview him every Tuesday, I transcribe him for a group of media members, and I do ask him a lot of questions. And he is a guy that admits his mistakes. You don't have to pry it out of him, and he seems to learn from them. I don't see a lot of repeat mistakes. So that's kind of my take on Al Golden with his B and no note, no detention, no note home to mom.
Yeah, I think a B is fair. He's had some regrettable play calls, like individual play calls, usually safety blitz related. But we talked about in the last question, the pressure on the defense has been pretty immense because the offense was so bad at times. And so I don't put a huge blame on Al Golden. I think there's certainly some things that he needed to figure out and get a sense for, in terms of how he could call the defense, what he could rely on Notre Dame's defensive players to be able to handle, and who he could put in those right positions. And so I think that there's certainly a learning curve there for any first year coach at a new school. I mean, we saw Marcus Freeman struggle with Notre Dame's defense a little bit to start the season last year, and sort of got things course corrected as well. So I think Marcus Freeman is probably pretty involved with the defense. I don't think he's like really hands off. From my perspective, anytime we ask him about something, even like post game about the defense, he can give you a pretty detailed response about what happened or why it happened. Whereas the offense, I think he needs to go back and review and talk to Tommy about it and get a little bit more insight. So I think he's pretty involved. So I don't know that he would be getting more involved than he is already. And the analyst thing, I mean, they're always going to hire analysts that can help the team. I get the sense that there may be some budget constraints there in terms of what Notre Dame has been allowed to do in terms of hiring support staff guys. I sort of got the sense for that when Tommy Reese
certainly was during the pandemic there was,
right, and I think they've been trying to push that way. But when Tommy Reese said, "Hey, we have an offensive analyst opening," I don't think it's because they can't get someone to do that. I think they're probably trying to get someone that maybe wanted more pay than they were allowed to pay that person or something like that. So I think that there may be some barriers there.
Tyler will do it.
That they're trying to work out. No, I will not. I will. That's a little bit more cutthroat than I'm looking for. And I know what the support staff people do because my youngest brother is a graduate assistant at Northern Illinois and has been a graduate assistant at a Division II program as well. So he knows I know the hours that he puts into that, and it, those are long, and they're not well paid either. So, I think that so all those things will be considered in the offseason in terms of trying to get more analysts. But it won't, I don't think it'll be like a response to how Al Golden's defense played this year. I don't know that that would be the reason that Notre Dame would be doing that. All right, next question is from RRH1 on the Insider Lounge. Do you expect more young players to see time in the last two games?
I would say a trickle, maybe. I asked Marcus Freeman about that on Monday, and he's certainly open to it. You know, Brian Kelly did the whole redshirt thing differently. He would kind of plot out specific games he wanted to play freshmen to get them to the four-game threshold. And it wasn't sequential. It wasn't, let's wait till we get to game 10 and then start playing them. It was, let's play them game 3, game 6, you know, whatever. There may be some special teams opportunities against elite opponents that he wanted to get better athletes on the field. But Marcus seems more, hey, it's week 10 now. We can open the gates and play some of these guys. About half of the freshmen haven't played at all. Jalen Snead and Jabron Payne joined the group last week. I think you'll see more of them. You know, the Boston College game, if it got to be really blowout territory, and who knows if that's going to happen, you might see some guys that hadn't played, even some sophomores like maybe Chance Tucker or some of the corners, you know, sophomore corners that got leapfrogged on the depth chart. Maybe they get into a game, but I don't think it's going to be a flood of young guys in the end of the season here, and certainly not at USC.
No, and especially since it's senior day, if there are opportunities like that, maybe they turn to a walk-on senior just to get him a couple reps. Like if we're at the point of the game where it does not matter at all, and they're just getting guys in there to have them get some experience of playing at Notre Dame Stadium, they would probably opt to the walk-on guys. Now, obviously, there may be a combination. It depends on the position in terms of what sort of senior walk-ons are at the positions where you have some freshmen that haven't played yet. But Marcus Freeman didn't really offer any other names in terms of guys that haven't played yet that he thought were going to be able to make an impact throughout the end of the season. So in terms of more guys, it would probably only be in that circumstance where we're talking like third string players getting into the game to get some reps. But so I don't know that I would expect to see more of those guys. Now maybe we see some more of the younger players who have continued to improve and earned more of those roles. Whether you talk about Prince Colley or someone like that, but and obviously like Tobias Merriweather, who has been playing quite a bit until he was sidelined with a concussion for the Navy game. So I don't expect a big influx of young players in the next two games, especially of guys that we haven't already seen. Next question is from @DOCarroll1. Are you expecting a good atmosphere in the stadium for senior day, or is it all an emotional distraction likely to lead to a slow start?
Okay, so I think those are two separate questions. If good atmosphere for senior day, people will be shivering, so they'll probably be moving around because it's going to be pretty cold. I think, you know, it's the last chance to see this team at Notre Dame Stadium, so I think it'll be a decent atmosphere. Now, will the senior day thing become a distraction? I mean, we've seen that. We've also seen them come out, you know, like gangbusters too. The fact that it's maybe a smaller production with 25 guys versus 45 or 50 might make it less of a distraction, but I don't know that this team gets just distracted at this point. The other thing is that some of these senior games, they've been such heavy favorites, and there's been kind of pressure to put away a team like that, and they'll be heavy favorites in this game. But I mean, whether Notre Dame goes 9-3 or 8-4 at this point isn't a huge difference in what's going to happen to them in the postseason. So I don't know. I I don't have a good answer for you. I wish I did. I'm just going to have to say claim word salad and passes to Tyler.
Yeah, no, I mean, I don't know how anyone can claim to know how Notre Dame is going to respond to anything this season based on how the season has gone. How the heck are we supposed to know? I don't know. I would imagine that, I don't know, maybe the way the season has gone, that the emotions are tamped down. Like I said, it's always still going to be like sad, or it's going to be something you're trying to soak in when it's the last time you play in Notre Dame Stadium. But like, I don't know if the senses will be as heightened because the season has been so weird, or maybe it's more, I don't know. I mean, I think it's, and it, also I think it's unfair.
You're giving a word salad too.
It's unfair to say that every person's going to react the same way. Everyone is going to have their own perspective for it. So we don't know that how Jason Adamola responds to it will be the same way Isaiah Foskey responds to it. So I think there's no way to know. In terms of the atmosphere, I would imagine it's muted because of the cold weather. Usually when it gets colder, the atmosphere is muted. I don't know that people are chomping at the bit to go out there and boo Boston College necessarily. And Phil Dracovic, if he's not playing, there'll be less opportunities to boo him too. Not that necessarily Notre Dame fans would do that, but maybe they would. I'm not going into Saturday's game saying, man, I can't wait to see what kind of atmosphere is going to be at the stadium. That's not something I would necessarily expect from a midday game against Boston College in mid-November. All right. Next question is, do you feel, or from Charles W. Wolf, do you feel Notre Dame's offense has an identity, or are we just going to have to take things one half at a time?
Well, I like my choices there. Yeah, I do think they have an identity, and I think that, yeah, we will have to take it one half at a time. I mean, again, there's been so many surprises this year, but I mean, they didn't change their identity. They just didn't play well in the second half and didn't maybe coach well in the second half. I will definitely say that. But I mean, their identity has become a team that's got a lot of physicality on offense, leans into their offensive line, who somehow didn't make the Joe Moore Award semifinalist list today, has the best tight end in football, has really good running backs, and doesn't have a great downfield passing game. What Navy kind of forced them to do is to lean into things that they haven't done, which is the downfield passing game. I mean, there were a lot of favorable matchups there, and Drew Pine took advantage. Tommy Reese took advantage. Braden Lindsey took advantage in the first half. In the second half, they didn't do that. So their identity didn't change. Their competency changed from one half to the next.
Yeah, I wasn't terribly surprised that Notre Dame didn't make the semifinalist list for the Joe Moore Award, because the bad games kept mounting, and especially this past one, the Navy game. Like, it wasn't a good game for Notre Dame's offensive line. 66 rushing yards against Navy, even though Navy's rushing defense is good, that's still not a performance worthy of the Joe Moore Award. And when you rush for 76 yards against Ohio State, 130 against Marshall, and 150 against Stanford, those aren't performances that make you say, hey, if we have to make a decision between a ninth team and a 10th team on our semifinalist list, that's not going to push Notre Dame ahead of someone else. So, but its identity still is, it wants to run the football and throw the ball to Michael Mayer. That's the identity of the offense. That doesn't mean it's always going to work, but that's what the identity is. Next question is from Baba Ganoush at @PLACT_ITFDB. How does Notre Dame run roughshod over Clemson's D? Wasn't it top five in rush defense before the ND game, which is loaded with 4 and 5 stars, yet gets totally stonewalled by Navy? I realize Navy has a good rush D, but is it that much better than Clemson's? Tell me there's an easy answer.
Yeah, there's an easy answer, I think. You know, Clemson is their run defense is their signature on that defense, but they are pretty competent in the pass game as well. Navy is polar opposites. I believe this week they're sixth out of 131 in run defense, 129 out of 131 in pass efficiency defense. Pass efficiency defense is the defining measure of how to determine a pass defense. That doesn't, you know, if somebody doesn't pass very often against your defense, but you give up a lot of yards and touchdowns, it's reflected in that number. So they're the sixth best run defense, the third worst pass defense in the country, and they invite you to beat them with the pass. And even Air Force, the number one rushing team in the nation, said, okay, we've got to throw some against Navy. And they threw for 156 yards against Navy in a win over Navy. Notre Dame in the first half took that path. And in the second half, I think they said, well, let's run the ball and put away the game like we did against Clemson. And Navy was just bound and determined to scheme up so that was going to be very difficult to do. And subsequently, that's what happened. So had Notre Dame taken the, you know, they wouldn't have been able to bleed the clock as much with the passing game. But, you know, maybe you go to the short passing game, a little bit more of a possession receiving type. But that's just the way Navy plays. They are going to force you to play, whether that's your strength or not. There's teams that were really good passing teams that have played Navy that say, sure, we'll take that. Go ahead and play nine guys in the box against our run. We're okay with that.
Yeah, and I think, well, one, I don't know that Notre Dame's fully committed to trying to run the football in the second half. And it didn't have success when it tried to run the football. And I think part of that is because there really wasn't a running game rhythm that was established in the first half because they were having so much success passing the football. And usually when you have success passing, like a team's going to respond by being less aggressive and maybe try to defend the pass. But Navy didn't do that. Navy's answer was like, no, we're still coming at you. We don't care that you were able to throw it past us for four passing touchdowns in the first half. We're still going to keep coming at you. And we're going to keep crowding the box, and we're going to challenge Drew Pine to do that for an entire game.
And even their run blitzes were great. You know, I mean, it wasn't just about sacking. They were getting in all the running lanes. It's like, where are you going to run?
Right. Yeah. And so I think that makes it like once because they're throwing so many different things at you, Notre Dame hasn't sort of found answers for that with any sort of consistency in the first half. It's harder to sort of just come out in the second half and expect that to sort of be working. With the Clemson game, I mean, Notre Dame was running the entire game. Like it wasn't like Notre Dame changed up its game plan in the second half. It just kept with it and was able to figure out what it needed to do and find that success there. And that just never really happened against Navy. So I think it's harder to do that when you're sort of switching modes. And I also, like I said at the start, I don't think Notre Dame ever really fully committed to trying to pound the football against Navy. I mean, it tried to pass on first down and then it would fail and then would run on second and third down and second and third down and long. And that's just that Navy didn't back off. They kept guys in the box in there. So there weren't easy running opportunities for Notre Dame to take advantage of. I think generally, and this is something I wanted to ask Marcus Freeman, but I didn't because I thought that he maybe wouldn't answer it because he didn't want to like disrespect Clemson. But I just think Navy sort of played more desperately than Clemson, like just to sort of like that in the second half, Navy was bound and determined to get back in that game. They were going to do whatever they had to do physically, schematically to try and get into that game. And I'm not sure that we saw that same kind of fight out of Clemson's defense. All right. Next question is from Irish Hawk at Leroy K25. How does Drew Pine look so good making throws we've been begging him to make in the first half to WTF was that in the second half?
In the second half, between the offensive line, Michael Mayer, Tommy Reese, and Drew Pine, they didn't have it together in the passing game. They weren't able to work against Navy's pressure. And Navy got five sacks. You know, if there weren't hot reads on certain routes, there should have been, given the defenses that they were seeing. And when there were, you know, some check downs, or maybe Drew could have gotten it quickly to the outside and let a receiver run a little bit, he needed to do that instead of holding onto the ball and looking downfield. So there was a lot of blame to go around with that. And that, I'll just leave it there.
Yeah, I think his pass protection failed him. I think some of the play calling failed him. He failed himself. He missed a big throw to Michael Mayer, which Drew Pine does from time to time. And so he sort of regressed to the mean a little bit when he was like so on point in that first half. Like it was only natural that he was going to miss something. Like he wasn't going to be Joe Montana for an entire game. Like he was going to come back to earth and miss a play there. And even on that play, he did get pressured from his right. And I don't think he was able to sort of step into the throw in the way that he maybe wanted or needed to be as accurate as he could have been. The batted pass that was intercepted, he made the right decision there. He just got outplayed. The cornerback who was blitzing figured out what he was doing and knocked the pass down, or knocked it up technically. There were a couple RPO, what I believe to be RPO play calls that he should have thrown the ball rather than handoff. I believe it was Notre Dame's second drive of the second half. On first and second down, like if you just sort of look, there's guys that run routes that would have been open for easy 5-6 yards minimum, that he just decided to hand the ball off. At least if I'm understanding what I believe the play call correctly, like you never know for sure if it's an RPO or if it's a called run, and the wide receivers are just running routes, so it looks that way. But it seems to me that that was there for Notre Dame's offense, I thought Navy sort of out-schemed Notre Dame and made it difficult on Drew Pine, and he didn't raise his game to the level that it needed to be in the second half. But I think a number of his teammates were in the same boat and didn't do that as well. All right, last question we have is from SJB75 on the Insider Lounge. Do you or Eric believe that Notre Dame will consider in the near future having a more liberal policy allowing Marcus Freeman to recruit and sign undergraduate transfer portal transfers?
They're working on it. I don't know that they're going to be able to find a compromise. You know, the dynamic that you're playing with there is that Notre Dame is looking at guys that are good students, but Notre Dame's transfer credit policy is so restrictive, it makes it difficult for that player to have enough transfer credits. Even somebody like Brandon Joseph, who's an upperclassman, coming from Northwestern, it was really difficult. I mean, given Northwestern's high standards, you know, Notre Dame, that's not good enough. So if there's compromise, it's going to be if the student is really good to maybe compromise on the transfer credits and say, okay, we're going to accept these classes as something that can work towards your Notre Dame degree. That's going to be a hard pill to swallow for some deans at Notre Dame. But again, if it's somebody that's an elite student or at least a very good student, you know, maybe there's some wiggle room there. So that's kind of where those conversations are, but there's not been movement at this point.
Yeah, I think it would be if and when there is, I think it'll probably be more gradual. I don't think it's just going to be like all of a sudden they're just going to like open the floodgates. I think they'll sort of pick and choose how they want to do it and use cases as examples to see if it's successful. We've seen some of women's basketball players transfer as undergraduates, and things seem to have gone fine with that. Brandon Joseph is sort of been the recent example for the football program. And it's not just like a football program specific thing, but it is probably going to impact the football program more than any other program. Although you can make the argument that basketball could be in a similar boat, but there's just so many more players in football that, and as the transfer portal market grows and Notre Dame is sort of locked out of so many of those options, it could be a competitive disadvantage for the football program. So Marcus Freeman's going to have to figure out how to push for that, why he feels it's necessary, and see if they can make some changes there that the gold won't start peeling off the dome if they start allowing some more undergraduate transfers. All right, that's it for today's episode of the Inside ND Sports Podcast. If you don't already, you can subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and other popular podcast platforms. If you like what you hear, give us a star rating, leave a review, and share our podcast feed with your favorite draft analyst, as long as it's not named Mike Renner, because he is already aware of our podcast as our guest on today's show. Check us out on YouTube if you're not subscribed to us there already. The Inside ND Sports channel is home to our Monday Night Live show and our Place Your Bets predictions for every week. And we will be back with another podcast next week to recap the Boston College game and get ready for the regular season finale at USC. Until then, stick with InsideIndySports.com for all your pregame and postgame coverage needs.